is open. Good morning, everyone, and welcome, House members. The first economic forecast of the year today. So let's bring up our economists, our team, and we will turn things over to you guys.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Oregon State Economist Mark McMullen, joined as always by my colleague Josh Lehner, here to provide the economic and revenue update. So for the most part, the economic and revenue outlook is tracking well. If anything, a little bit faster, both in terms of jobs and income and in terms of our tax revenue than we previously expected. And so we're right now, in terms of our revenue, really for the 15-17 biennium, we're still sitting in the sweet spot where we have a little bit more resources available than was expected when the budgets were drafted in 2015, but yet still below the kicker threshold where we'll have to put any of the, send the excess revenues back to taxpayers. In general, at the U.S. level, the economic expansion is, if anything, firming. The consensus of forecasters out there are starting to become a little bit more sanguine about the near term. That is, they're less worried about recession in the immediate future. And a lot of that has to do with something that's particularly good for Oregon, which is the situation for manufacturers. The one thing that really didn't vibe with a growing economy over the last year or two at the U.S. level has been industrial production or manufacturing operations and the production of goods, where we saw a real pullback right about the time that energy prices fell and that the dollar strengthened. And at first, that weakness was really concentrated in energy-related industries, while overall output and production was dropping, wasn't too worrisome for us, given that we weren't really exposed to a lot of the weakest of the industries. But over time, that spread, and we've really now seen a good two-year period or so where we have not really seen any increase in industrial production, which is, you know, something that never happens outside of recessions, or we haven't seen before. But now, in recent months, we're starting to see improvement. That, in particular, our measures of what's in the pipeline, new orders, and what purchasing managers at different manufacturers are doing in terms of their demand for parts and the like, look like we may have turned a corner. And so this would be consistent with what most U.S. forecasters are saying, that this soft spot in manufacturing is something that will probably just muddle through. And to date, it looks like that may well happen. At the Oregon level, We're tracking real close to the forecast as well, which means we're starting to see a slowdown. I've argued here before that now that the labor market in Oregon has taken out most of the slack, it's hard to sustain the real breakneck job gains we've seen in the last year or two, the 4,000 or 5,000 jobs a month. And we expect at some point in the near term to transition down to sustainable levels. And that does appear to be manifesting itself in the employment data now, that the last half year or so of employment data in Oregon has shown slower rates of growth. But nevertheless, as you see here, still significantly faster than the U.S. average as a whole, doing much better than the U.S. and, you know, maybe not twice as fast as we were during a year ago, but still a significant growth advantage. Nonetheless, we're still seeing a tremendous amount of population gains and a lot faster income gains as well. So while a tight labor market means we're going to see slower job gains going forward, for the most part, a lot of good things are coming as well. We're ahead of the curve in terms of the U.S. and in terms of where we are in our recovery / expansion, and we're starting to see the fruit of that. In particular, we're seeing these tight labor markets, meaning less available workers, harder to find workers. There's not a big army of unemployed folks out there looking for jobs that that employers can choose from. So as a result, they're bidding up wages. So we've seen a lot faster wage growth here than in the U.S. Our average wages are higher relative to the U.S. than they've been since the mills closed in the 80s. And so that's really encouraging, and it's starting to trickle down into some more sticky measures of economic well-being, the last things to turn around. In particular, we're seeing large gains in terms of income for our low-income households have done very well. They're still not back to where they were in inflation-adjusted terms relative to before the recession. Low-income households always get hit really hard during recessions, and this one was no different, where they took a disproportionate amount of the blow. But in terms of the recovery over the last 3 years, the gains have been significant and really striking. And now we're actually finally getting to the last things that turn around in terms of our data flow, which would be poverty rates and the caseloads for need-based health care and income maintenance programs. We're finally starting to see those turn down as well, which is very encouraging here and something that where we would be leading the U.S. Another way that the recovery here has become more broad-based, and one that's particularly encouraging is it's become more broad-based across regions of the state. In particular, here we're looking at growth rates for employment in Portland, in our metropolitan areas, and then in non-metropolitan counties in Oregon. And as you see here, at 2% year over year, our rural areas in Oregon are growing as fast and even slightly faster than the U.S. average, which is remarkable. And this is as good as it gets for our rural areas. Right now, we have all our counties except for one have added jobs over the last year, which is very, very, very extremely rare. And the one county that hasn't is actually a success story for rural Oregon, that being Morrow County. Technically, over the last year, Morrow County has shed some jobs as a result of some large construction projects at the port winding down. But nevertheless, if you stand back and look at the business cycle as a whole, Morrow has done better than really any rural county out there, and that's including shaking off the negative effects of the closure of the Umatilla Weapons Depot. And so with that, we're in this good mature expansion. It appears that at the U.S. level, things are stable for now as well, which means we should continue to grow, maybe if not at the rates we have in the past. The big risk right now facing us, a lot of them in terms of both at the macro level and at the local level, state level, would be with federal policy, both fiscal and monetary policy. And usually in front of this group, we steer clear of policy, in particular state policy. By our process, we use a current law forecast. So what you'll see here in terms of our revenue numbers and the like are all based on Oregon law today. And so regardless of how likely a change is in the future for you as a legislature to enact, we don't put it in until the governor signs it. But with federal policy, that's not possible for us to do. The way we work federal policy into the forecast is to maintain our objectivity and keep it 3,000 miles away. We look to our vendors for assumptions on the changes in federal policy, of which we have some, in terms of expected tax cuts and less regulation for banks and more infrastructure spending and the like. But where it fails to help us is we don't. With this process, it keeps it objective and at arm's length, but then we don't really get a good understanding of how that feeds into our economic outlook. We don't know what the tax cut, so how much of that are they putting into the employment outlook, and how much is that boosting in the near term, or how much do they expect infrastructure spending to add to the economy? And so it's hard for us, without knowing what's in that black box, how they translate their policy assumptions into economic data, it's hard for us to rule any in or out, decide whether or not they're appropriate to use in Oregon. So with that, I'm going to let Josh start to dig into some of these that are of particular importance for our state.
Thanks, Mark. For the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. As Mark was saying, there's a lot of uncertainty coming from federal fiscal policy in particular. And when we look across a lot of the most discussed options or most discussed policies, both on the campaign trail and in more recent months, they kind of fall into two buckets. The first bucket are things that will impact the U.S. economy in a general sense and will impact Oregon probably roughly to the same degree as the typical state. And then the second bucket are things that will impact Oregon to a larger degree than the typical state, both upside and downside risk associated with some of these potential federal policies. And when it comes to policies, the devil's always in the details. You know, campaign trail promises very rarely word for word turn into actual legislation. And we have seen not too much clarity given on exact federal legislation at this point in time. However, again, from this big picture perspective, what are the types of topics and potential policies being discussed? And on the general sense, the first three listed there, taxes, infrastructure spending, and deregulation, particularly when it comes to maybe the finance sector and banking regulations and maybe some environmental protections and the like, the consensus of economic forecasters, our main vendors included, have sort of solidified around this outlook that is at least moderately expansionary, right? If we cut taxes for on the personal side for households, and if we lower the corporate tax rate, maybe with some base broadening, and we increase infrastructure spending across the nation, we're going to see stronger economic growth, right? So even the consensus of forecasters have settled on this as a moderately expansionary outlook, a couple tenths of a percent of GDP growth, not tremendously ups relative to what we've seen in recent years, but still stronger in the near term. Over the longer term, maybe a little bit weaker growth as we sort of get a boost to initial growth, and then it comes off a little bit in a few years. And these are sort of the things that the forecasters are focusing on. They're focusing on the positive short-term economic gains. They're not necessarily focusing on some of these other policies. However, we wanted to take just a quick minute to step through probably each of these other ones that maybe will impact Oregon a little bit more than the typical state. The first one relates to international migration and the foreign-born population in Oregon. We have a slightly smaller share than the typical state of foreign-born population. This includes both people with legal citizen status and those that are of illegal nature. And as you can see here, the vast majority of them, or at least 40% of the foreign-born population here in the state of Oregon, were born in Mexico, right? That's where the plurality or near majority of our foreign-born population was coming from. When did they come to Oregon? Predominantly in the 1990s and the 2000s. Since the Great Recession, we've seen very little international migration, particularly from Mexico, and this is for at least two reasons. One is just simple demographics. The birth rate has been falling in Mexico. It's fallen across the Western Europe and in the U.S. too, of course, but the demographics have slowed in Mexico too, so the available stock of people that could potentially immigrate to the country is down. And so, therefore, there's fewer people that could to migrate today, particularly young working age males. The flip side of this is also economic conditions. The Mexico economy was not doing well, say, in the 1990s. They had a currency crisis at the same time. A lot of people were coming north for better employment opportunities. In the last decade, the Mexican economy has actually done pretty well, unlike the U.S. economy, which had a very, very severe recession. We're just now starting to get back to some sort of full employment type economy, and so therefore the economic incentives have switched in the last decade, where maybe it is the payoff is not quite as large to come north and look for employment opportunities. Now that the U.S. economy is kind of back to a full employment situation, or at least reasonably close to it, we're not all the way there, and the U.S. dollar is strong, the Mexican peso is weak again, maybe those economic incentives has flipped again to such that coming to the U.S. to work may be a better economic opportunity for some working-age households from Mexico and Latin America more broadly. Of course, federal policy and some of the things that have come out in recent weeks, executive orders and whatnot, may change some of those incentives at the same time. Probably more importantly, when it comes to potential economic impacts, particularly here in Oregon, would be manufacturing, supply chains, globalization, trade patterns, all those sort of things that we're talking about. When we started digging into the data, one thing that really became apparent is it's not so much bilateral trade between two particular countries or a given state like Oregon and trade with Mexico or trade with China. By and large, most states have very little direct trade exposure to any particular country or even region of the world for that matter. It's really much more global in that sense. So if we were to renegotiate NAFTA or we were to have strained trade relations with a particular country, the economic impact of that factor alone is likely to be fairly small. What we're talking about here when it comes to worsening trade relations more broadly are global supply chains. That's something you try and get at here. About 20% of manufacturing in the U.S., about the intermediate goods and parts that go into the manufacturing process here in the U.S., are imported from abroad. Now, that varies by sector. Here we list out a bunch of the different subsectors for manufacturing, but every single manufacturing sector relies on something that's imported. It might just be a particular valve for an appliance manufacturer in the Midwest, or this particular machine at a paper mill here in the Northwest, or maybe it's a particular raw material, a raw earth material that goes into high-tech manufacturing here locally. But they're coming from abroad, and so to the extent that strained trade relations kind of gunk up the supply chain or the process of which you source these materials or these parts over the entire world, then you'd expect the impact of international relations worsening to be spread broadly across the entire economy. Again, it won't be anything particular related to one country, but much more broader than that. So that's the potential concern that we're looking at when it comes to risk from the manufacturing sector and international relations.
Oh, Jesus.
And that's right. And
that's a $5 fine.
So, and obviously this is important more than just manufacturing. Here we have data. In manufacturers, we have data for the inputs and the outputs, and we can talk about the supply chain kind of explicitly. But exposure to terms of trade is obviously a much bigger issue than that. Our service exports here, we've heard a lot from higher education, the universities, very much concerned about terms of trade and the demand for foreign students coming and taking advantage of their services. And also we certainly know that our design cluster in Portland is very highly tied, although we don't have explicit numbers like we do for the manufacturing industries. So the next risk that's disproportionate here in Oregon has to do with the Medicaid expansion that took place under the Affordable Care Act. In general, Oregon does not benefit from federal spending to the same degree as does the typical state. Most states have more federal workers and they get more federal transfers. In one large difference that stands out is Oregon doesn't have big military contractors or a defense base or things like that, which you know tend to bring in some pretty large numbers. But what we do have are things like Postal Service, BLM, Forest Service workers, and the like. But not as much as the typical state. But what we are good at in terms of exploiting federal resources would be signing eligible folks up for some of these need-based programs. And in particularly, we did a very good job with the federal Medicaid expansion. Before the expansion, we ranked just about in the middle of states in terms of our Medicaid grants per capita. Somewhere right in the middle, around 25th or so, but as soon as they passed the expansion, we moved up into number fifth or sixth across states in terms of the amount of funding. So this is a significant amount of dollars. We're talking about $6 billion over a biennium. Maybe not all of that's injected into the economy. We know some of it's in hospital margins. Hospitals are doing well, and particularly since they have a lot less charity care that they have to put outlays for now. And, of course, some of it also flows to outside of the state as well, to equipment manufacturers or the like. But nevertheless, the numbers are big, and we've done quite well relative to the typical state in terms of drawing them in, and so there would be a noticeable impact should this be rolled back.
Potentially the last major thing that's being discussed at the federal level that would have an outsized impact on Oregon would be any sort of changes regarding federal land use policies. And here, particularly, we're thinking potentially timber harvest on federal lands. If you look over the last couple generations, you know, what has changed regarding to the timber harvest, we all know the biggest declines have been on the federal lands. State and local lands are actually up considerably, but they remain such a small player in the overall harvest market that impact is positive on the industry, but not, they doesn't nearly offset the decline in federal lands. And so to the extent that we cut more trees, we would have more jobs. And so then that would be a positive in terms of the short-run economic outlook for the state. Somewhere in the magnitude, if we doubled the harvest on federal lands, we're talking 4,000 to 5,000 additional timber and related employment jobs. And the feedback effects on that in terms of revenue, that's a short-term positive. And, of course, that's leaving to the side any discussion about environmental impacts and longer-run sustainability issues or what have you. The second thing regarding maybe not federal land policy, but the timber industry is potentially re-engaging or re-implementing a Canadian softwood lumber agreement. Generally, trade protectionism is bad for the economy, particularly when you take into account all players. However, in the short term, if you put in some protectionary measures, that protected industry sees a positive impact. And so what we're talking about here is when the softwood lumber agreement lapsed or ended a few years back, the Canadians were allowed to, they've sent a little bit larger share of imports of some of their lumber into the U.S. market. And now they're talking about potentially renegotiating that and putting it back. Therefore, the Canadian imports would decline relative to where they are right now. That would help with purchasing power or final selling power margins for the lumber mills today. So they'd be able to get a better price for their finished product should the Canadian imports be smaller. What it won't help with are the log prices. Log prices are high. And so partly due to the external demand from China, Korea, Japan, and Asia more broadly. And so that wouldn't help the mills with the log prices, but it would help them with their final prices. And so they could get a little bit better margins or overall business structure. And that's something to look for, you know, for a positive upside risk for the short-term economic impact in the state.
But unfortunately, it just doesn't have the same kick that it used to. As Josh said, you double the harvest on public lands and 4,000 jobs. As you see here, that's really what we gain in 1 month. And the problem is obviously technology is the enemy. Our mills are so much more productive now that we can produce the same amount with many, many fewer workers. But in terms of the economic outlook, as you see here, two things, right? The jobs per month, you can tell that the slowdown is certainly here.
I can wait to the end.
Oh, I'm sorry. This isn't visible yet in terms of the real-time data, but with the preliminary benchmarking that both we and the Employment Department do, suggests that we've had a relatively soft half a year. But going forward, we expect to continue to transition down somewhere in between 2,000 and 3,000 jobs a month, which is enough to keep up with the new workers we're bringing into the labor force from in terms of population growth and people moving to the state. Relative to the forecast, recent forecast, and the forecast, in particular the December forecast 3 months ago, this is a little bit stronger in the near term and a little bit towards out. Two things going on here. One is we're tracking a little bit faster than we expected. And secondly, the feed-through impact of a stronger U.S. forecast from our vendors are both bringing this up slightly as we go forward. And that is reflected in a little bit more revenue as we head out. So far, so good in terms of the revenue outlook. As I said before, we're still tracking for most of our major indicators very close to what was expected at the close of session forecast in 2015. This is encouraging, but as always, we the verdict is out until we process the tax returns in April. Being in personal income tax state, we're just about to see a lot of those come in, and this could change the numbers drastically, as is typically the case. But for now, we're right about on, but certainly don't want to crow about that, given that we could be eating that crow here in a couple of months. But for the personal income tax, the biggest one of the batch, we're looking to be pretty much on track. And what does on track mean? Well, on track meant we were going to have a pretty soft first half of the biennium and then start to see things pick up. And that appears to have been the case, where we've seen here The dark blue line being the most recent forecast with actual values through the end of 2016. And over that last year or so, you see there really was very little growth in our collections. But there was a reason for that, and that was the payout of the personal income tax kicker that was generated in the 13-15 biennium. Instead of going out as a check, it now is part of the standard tax process where taxpayers will get either a larger refund or a smaller bill at the end of the year when they file their taxes for this kicker. And that happened over the past year during the starting in early 2016 when tax returns for the 2015 tax year were filed. We started paying out these kicker. But now it's that's behind us now. It'll never be entirely behind us because taxpayers for years and years go back and amend our taxes or get enforcement activities to make them pay. They'll be paying their 2015 taxes, 10 years from now, some small portion, but the vast majority is out the door. Of the $402 million kicker, we've seen we've already accounted for $370 million of it on tax returns, and some unknown quantity as well is taken up by both folks that don't file for it and lose it, and more importantly, by offsets that we're, in a while, we'll get a better idea of that. What offsets are is when the taxpayer owes the Department of Revenue or Child Support or the like, and they're due a kicker refund check, then the department goes ahead and keeps that check. So it's that appears to be in the rearview mirror now, and gains should continue going forward. As you see here, the qualitatively the forecast is really no different from May 2015. If I had put the December forecast in here, you wouldn't be able to differentiate it visually. But nevertheless, the numbers are still big. This qualitatively not different, but certainly from a budget perspective different. The gap there you see, just that little sliver between the two, is on the order of $200 million a year. So that's significant in terms of budget implications, but in terms of the forecast, the qualitatively it's the same. That is, after the pause for the kicker, we see some steady growth going forward. Ever volatile corporate taxes are harder to track, but they're encouraging as well. Here you see the same chart comparing the close of session forecast with the most current one. We at both at the close of session and recently we've come to the realization that corporate taxes are running ahead of schedule in terms of being higher than underlying profitability would suggest. And so we've had them coming back down to earth for some time. The question is really, where do they land? And it appears that hopefully we're almost there. The last three or four months of corporate taxes have been very strong, and they've stopped the bleeding, where we were falling at 25-30% year-over-year rates up until the end of 2016, and it appears that those may well have bottomed out as the forecast calls for. But nevertheless, given that this decline didn't happen as immediately as we expected at the close of session, corporate taxes are running a bit ahead of forecast now. And so this would generate a kicker, a corporate income tax kicker, which now would be dedicated through K-12 spending, $36.2 million as of current estimates for the potential corporate kicker. And now, as I said, all bets are always off when we're heading into the peak tax filing season. But this year, uncertainty is even more pronounced than normally. For one, we have delayed refunds. When we come in front of you here at the end of February, in a normal year, we would have about a third of our refund checks already out the door. that would start of, have started going out in January. This year, both at the federal and the state level, we went ahead and delayed until February 15th, and so we're only now starting to see some of those big numbers show up. So we're not exactly sure where we're tracking relative to the past. And the other reason we're having trouble knowing exactly where we're tracking relative to the past is the impact of the IT system replacement at the Department of Revenue. So for a lot of our revenue concepts and the like, we're having trouble comparing them in year-over-year basis with past years and reconciling them with other pieces of data that we have and the like, and it'll take a while until this all fleshes out. Right now, the most alarming one is in the withholding data, as you see here. You can guess when the new system went online there at the end of 2016, and we started to get see some 0 days in terms of banking deposits when normally we get $20-30 million a day, and but that has reversed itself pretty dramatically here in the last few weeks. So we're still trying to figure out where this is going to land in terms of withholding when we get some of the data issues ironed out. But it'll take a while for not just withholding, but the corporate taxes and the personal income taxes as well, where we're seeing some anomalies in the top line data. But it's worth noting that the IT system replacement wasn't done to, you know, in order to make our lives easier in terms of the data and the like. It was more to protect against catastrophic loss, you know, working off of the greens on Fortran and the like. It was only a matter of time before, you know, something really bad happened to the system. So they needed to update it, but, you know, but that, you know, and which has been done, you know, successfully in terms of the transactions, but it'll take a while, I think, until the 30,000 foot view that we take will be able to, you know, make sense of all the new numbers. We do have some numbers post-mortem for the end of the 2015 tax year now. The Department of Revenue put to bed the 2015 returns, and this is an idea of the different categories of income and how they've been growing. The real takeaway here is that investment sorts of income, aside from interest, have been doing very well in recent years. At the top of the list there in 2015 is Schedule E income, capital gains income, proprietor's income, other business income, and the like. Continue to lead the way as they have over the last couple, 3 years. But going forward in 2016, as we process this next round of tax returns, we expect this to flip somewhat. In particular, we're expecting some weakness in terms of capital gains and some of the other types of investment income that taxpayers get to have some discretion over when they cash it in for tax purposes. And part of what's going on here is with federal policy. And here's somewhere where we know federal policy is probably playing a role, even though there's uncertainty over what it's going to be. While it's uncertain what the federal government is going to do in terms of fiscal policy, it's becoming a bit of conventional wisdom out there that tax cuts and potentially capital gains tax cuts are likely. And so what does this mean? It means that accountants and investment advisors and the like are starting to tell people to maybe hold off on some of their realizations of these gains. If you cash it in next year, you might get 17% tax rate instead of a 25% tax rate if you cash it this year. And we know in the past that, you know, these changes in policy have really moved the boat a lot in terms of things like capital gains. In fact, in the 1980s, the Reagan tax reforms really created a massive swing. Since then, policymakers have been a little more savvy, and they tend to make these things retroactive to try to, you know, minimize that. But nevertheless, investors are forward-looking, and a lot of folks right now are expecting to have a better deal if they hold off on cashing things out. So for 2016, that's kind of putting a lid on what we expect to get this April relative to what we've seen in terms of the appreciation of asset markets and stuff like that. When we can see stock markets going like they have been, typically that would mean a huge big capital gains present at the end of the year or April surprise. This time, because of the policy, the policy impacts, probably not. But again, this is the hardest thing for us to forecast, these sort of investment type incomes and what's going to get paid in on April. There is one alternative measure that's supporting our basic models as well, and that's recent estimated payments. I've shown this the last couple of Aprils because we use this as a sanity check for our complicated models to say, well, we've noticed with taxpayers, while no accountants right now have filled out any high income filers returns yet, and they won't do it until even after April 15 a lot of the time. They just put in the payments. They do start to look forward, or taxpayers do start to look forward towards the end of the year. Typically with estimated payments, here estimated payments are what you send in with a coupon, stuff that's not withheld. Typically it comes out of investment income or business income or the like, when people have to make quarterly payments to avoid penalty. And to avoid penalty, typically you have to pay as much as you did last year at least. And so in most quarters, our models exploit that and say that, well, how much did you pay last year and how much growth have we had? And this really drives a lot of the behavior in terms of estimated payments. Well, there's one quarter when that's different, and that's usually this last one, the December-January payment, which is a very big one. But we see that move sometimes a little bit more prospectively, where taxpayers, as you get toward the end of the tax year, they start to realize that, oh, well, maybe I'm going to have a big bill, or maybe I'm going to have a huge refund coming to me, because I had a really good year or a bad year, and maybe I paid too much or too little. And they they use this last quarterly payment, some of them, to adjust the hit that's going to happen in April, either positive or negative. So in past years, you see here, it's been roughly in line. You get the same sort of qualitatively. If this last estimated payment is up a lot, those April returns are going to be up a lot. If it's down a lot, those returns are going to be down a lot, and so forth. Not a perfect measure, but a pretty good one. Here, the forecast was put together by the research folks over at Department of Revenue, who help us a lot. This is just looking at a scatter plot, and a simple regression line would suggest we were going to get somewhere around 5 or 6% growth in our finals this final season, which happens to be right about where our standard models would land. So that's pretty nice. There is some uncertainty here too as well. Again, with the new data system is complicating matters. Under the new data system, they are no longer able to give us estimated payments, the payments that come in with coupons or whatnot. That's not something that they normally track. Luckily for us, the research team over the DOR has spent a lot of time trying to replicate this, and they make an estimate of it for us now. Estimated payments or something, an estimate of estimated payments for us. Hopefully it's good. Unfortunately, we only had a short period of time where we actually had the old system and the new system parallel, and so there is a possibility that these will behave differently going forward.
We had two follow-ups on some previous discussions that we had, both last quarter and a couple quarters before that. The first one was estate tax. Last time we were in front of you 3 months ago, we had just been coming off a record level of estate tax collections for a single month. That first really sharp blue bar there you see, about $45 million in a month, more than twice anything we'd seen historically. And then we had 3 months of normal collections, $8, $9, $10 million a month. And then in the most recent month, again, we saw a near record level of estate tax collections. This right here are two massive outliers regarding the entire history of the estate tax collections in the state of Oregon. Makes forecasting difficult. Our estate tax forecast has been raised 40 to 50% relative to the close of session. It's a massive forecasting error. And it's all come in these two big months, or 80% of that error has come in these two big months. And it's a very limited number of estates here. It's not that we had a large amount of fairly wealthy people that have passed away in a given month or filed their taxes at the same time. It's that there have been a few isolated incidences of extremely wealthy individuals and households that have passed away that have driven these results. And so, again, just an update. We still have a longer-term outlook. We don't have, our, as we talked about before, our longer-term outlook does not incorporate the massive run-up in asset prices because, according to tax professionals and a lot of our revenue advisors, estate planning and planning around the estate tax itself is a pretty easy thing to do in terms of gifting and trust and all that sort of stuff. So we still have more muted growth in the outlook relative to just what the stock market and housing prices are doing. That said, we have been raising it up, particularly given the baseline. Even if you throw out these 2 months of really extreme revenue events, we are seeing modestly higher revenue. So our estate tax forecast is being raised up, but we're not expecting incidences quite like this to occur again. That doesn't mean they won't, but we're not, you know, it's hard to predict something along these lines. The other follow-up question was regarding something Senator Boquist brought before us or asked us 3 months ago, is what is the effective tax rate on marijuana relative to tobacco? And so finding good market data is a little bit challenging, or it's very dated. We were talking three years ago for good cigarette tax data across all states. And so supplemented that with some unscientific methodology of going into a couple convenience stores and gas stations and shopping and looking at what the prices are.
Did you do the marijuana too?
We'll start with the marijuana. Thank you, Senator Boquist. The average price per gram there, $8.76 per gram, is across state. That's for the first quarterly tax returns that have been filed with the Department of Revenue. The full forms they fill out, how much did they sell, you know, what price points, all that sort of good stuff. Turned out to be about that, $8.76 a year ago. So we're putting a 17% to 20% sales tax on it today. 17% state, 0% to 3% local, depending upon whether the voters pass that. So that's where we are with the marijuana effective tax rate. Now, if we look at tobacco, the effective tax rates are considerably higher, and then depending upon which brand or price point you're purchasing at, the effective tax rates can be above 100%. Because when it comes to marijuana, we're doing it on a sales basis. So it doesn't matter if you're buying the skunky stuff or the Maui Wowie, the effective tax rate's the same. When it comes to cigarettes and tobacco, we're doing it on a per unit basis, right? The tax per pack, or the tax technically per individual cigarette, is a fixed given cost. So if you're buying a name brand pack of cigarettes, a Camel or Marlboro's, if you go to the gas station, paying $6.50 to $7 a pack, that makes the effective tax rate 50-55%. If you're buying, I was talking with a convenience store owner, actually, and I was asking him, okay, so of all the stuff on behind you see the counter, what sells the most? I was like, is it the Camels or whatever? He just laughed at me, and he reached below the counter, pulled out something I'd never heard of, a generic brand that was $4.25 a pack, right? And you can see these generic brands that maybe you don't see advertising for or you know, the signs outside the gas station for, were significantly lower cost. Now, because we're taxing it on a per unit basis instead of a sales basis, that makes the effective tax rates considerably higher. And the same thing applies to the moist stuff per can or per tin. Now you can get better pricing than you see here. This is, again, just the walk-up price at a gas station. But if you go to the discount stores or you buy in bulk or that sort of stuff. But again, the effective tax rate on tobacco is significantly higher than on marijuana. Now policy-wise, when it comes to the marijuana, what the ballot measure was designed to do and some of the policies put in place was to make sure we kept that tax rate low to get better black market conversion, right? So we wanted to get as much of the illegal stuff into the legal market, and so they on purpose kept the tax rate low. That said, you can see the disparities across these particular items. The last thing to highlight is the last set of numbers. How big are these revenue streams to the state, right? And if you look at the most recent year, or the first year of marijuana collection, $60 million. Now, that was in a 25% tax environment. The tax rate has dropped to 17% at the state level. So if we didn't see an increase in sales, you'd think the numbers this year would be a little bit lower than $60 million for the state's portion. For cigarettes, and 0%, zero of that money is general fund. Now, it's spent kind of on general fund type programs, but 0% of it's in the official general fund, and so 0% of its forecasting is in our office. We're not doing that. We're just estimating some of these trends and keeping an eye on the market. Cigarettes, a couple $100 million per year, about $30-35 million of that's general fund share. to other tobacco products, $60 million. About a little over half of that is general fund money. The rest is dedicated to tobacco use reduction programs and share with the cities and counties and things like that.
That's right. And just one comment. Although the effective tax rates are very high on cigarettes, I think it does bear noting that the state taxes are much lower here than relative to our neighbors to the north and the south. So forecast changes. Well, the dynamics of the forecast changes are pretty much the same for this current biennium, which you see here, and the next one, 17-19, that you're about to draft budgets for. And it's higher, you see here, 113.6 over the close of session, 102.7 net above what was expected in December. So $100 million in additional revenues, and those are spread out among really four factors. As we said, you know, a lot of stuff is tracking ahead. So we have the personal income tracking a little bit ahead, $30 million, corporate another $30 million, estate taxes, as you saw, another $30 million, and then 10 or so for liquor taxes. The liquor taxes are forecast for us by the OLCC. We use the agency's forecast for these. For some time now, they've been tracking a little bit low on their forecast and have decided to increase the growth rate over time for OLCC. And you'll see that does make a significant difference. It's once we get into the out years as those growth rates compound. Excuse me. It's really a wide range of things. Most things are tracking a little bit ahead of what we expected. One that's not in here is a non-general fund is video lottery. That is tracking a little bit behind in recent weeks for a couple of reasons, one being the winter storms we had. The weekly sales took a big hit during the storms, and we also suspect that there's some downward pressure being put on weekly sales in January as well with the lack of income tax refund money going out. But that will be released here shortly. But so the upshot here of $100 million in additional revenues or $100 million from the change of session forecast, what does that mean? Well, it means we're about a third of the way to a kicker. We're still in, again, that sweet spot where there's $113 million more here than was expected when the budgets were written, but we only have another $200 to $300 million in room above us before that is no longer accessible, would be returned to the taxpayers, that extra $100. And so, which, like I say, given the uncertainty that always surrounds the income tax filing season, either way could still be possible, you know, either coming in low to where we end up below the change of closed session forecast or getting this extra $300 million and getting into the kicker territory there. So, but for right now, we're right still in the window for 2015-2017. Going forward, we continue to see similar sized increases, although they do compound as we get into the out years. The out years are larger, particularly with personal income tax. This is flowing from a stronger job forecast, which over 5 or 6 years really does create some pretty large numbers in terms of dollar values. But again, we're up 102.6 in general and lottery funds for the current biennium, 92.6 for the next biennium, and increases going forward. You do see the gray line for the other being quite large, around $75 million in these out years. That is predominantly the higher OLCC forecast that we've adopted. So to wrap up, although these growth rates change a little bit, we expect a somewhat of a softer biennium next time, between 8% or 9% growth in available resources. But the typical biennium going forward is somewhere there, 8%, 9%, 10%, which doesn't quite match what we're used to, but it's in keeping with the slower demographic growth and the like. But nevertheless, or the slower labor force growth and the like due to demographics. But there is a structural issue here with, if we're growing at 8, 9, 10% of biennium in terms of our revenue, unfortunately, that's not enough to keep up with the spending side. Although you know, the cost of most current service level to go ahead and map that forward for most of our state programs probably is in the 8-10% rate. There are a couple of big counterexamples, the largest being, of course, healthcare costs. And healthcare costs over the next biennium are growing much faster than this, creating a structural problem. One very encouraging thing is where we are with our reserves. Due to the work of this committee, there have been some automatic deposits into both the Education Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Fund over time, which has been our most successful work in terms of revenue reform that we've done here in Oregon, and it's really paying dividends. Here you see, as of today, we're over the $1 billion mark in terms of reserves. By the end of next biennium, we expect, if things don't go into the toilet, we expect to be up around the over the 7% of biennial revenue mark, which is quite good. Most states report, 7% of annual revenue, not 7% of 2-year revenue. So this is encouraging that we have so many reserves, and people are really starting to notice. And to the extent that you guys can enact more of these automatic deposits that kind of get a bite of the apple before it gets into the budget process, I think the more stable our revenues will be going forward. But in particular, giving presentations to the rating agencies out there, they have really started to notice this. They're very excited about this, and the potential that we have here, these numbers are getting big, where we could smooth out some of the problems caused by the volatile nature of our personal income tax and the like. I don't know if we're quite to AAA yet. There's still those pesky citizens initiatives that the rating agencies don't like those, because those can, as you know, can be budget busters for sure. So with that, that's it for our prepared comments, but we'd be happy to entertain any questions if you have them.
Questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, gentlemen, thank you. Very, very professional, very, very well done. First, I want to make a statement to previous leadership in the House and the Senate for having the foresight to put those reserves together. I think as a person who serves on Ways and Means as well, at some point in the future, that is going to be a blessing for the state of Oregon. Just a quick question for you. Can you help me better understand, as a legislator from rural Oregon, actually from Morrow County?
Oh.
By the way, thank you for the plug for Morrow County. We appreciate that. Help me understand what's your folks' definition of non-metro or of rural?
Yes, Senator Haas, Representative Smith. The technical definition of that is each metropolitan area now is made up of whole counties. And so for the Portland metropolitan area, for example, now it's considered to be the Tri-County area plus Columbia and Yamhill, and whatnot. And Eugene Metro is just the one, just Lane County and the like. But so non-metro would be taking out any of those counties that are associated with one of our metropolitan areas. So we get rid of the Bend area, Medford, Eugene, Corvallis, Portland, and Salem.
Before Salem. Yeah. So just one observation. I appreciated the comments on the timber industry slide. But the one thing I want to point out to the audience and to Oregonians is, even though it may result in only 4,000 to 5,000 jobs total statewide, those jobs and their placement in rural Oregon has a huge impact. So, for example, 20 jobs in Little Wheeler County, as you folks know, is the equivalent of Intel or Nike doing a major expansion for that small remote county. And so I just want to make sure we get that comment on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Boquist.
Thank you. No, you're not going to skate out, okay. Could you go back and talk a little bit, which you did not? You talked about the issues in terms of, job growth, so on and so forth, tightening job market. But you and I appreciate the marijuana slide, so you thought I was going to talk about pot, okay? Could you go back to workforce participation? Because, as you know, we have a horrid workforce participation number in the country, which then has a direct impact on people that are actually shopping for jobs. So have we made any progress on workforce participation or not?
Chair Hass, Senator Boquist. We certainly have in recent months, and unfortunately, too much to be believed if you look at the most recent employment data. They go back, and the last time we had a benchmark was January, if I'm right, of last year. September of 2015. So, yeah, so even farther back than I would have thought, another quarter. Anyway, so we had already started to see labor force participation in Oregon improve, start to pick up before then. But over this past year of non-benchmark data, it has really been jumping up, where we've had really big numbers of folks returning to the labor force in Oregon. And so this is good. And it's starting to come back. It'll never get back to where it was in the past because of the demographic changes. So what we do in our office is we try to say, okay, well, we start at 2000 and say, well, if everyone within an age cohort every year, your 50-year-olds, your 51-year-olds, 52-year-olds, participated in the labor force at that steady rate from 2000 and that was stuck, and then we just age that population over time, what would happen? And we'd get more than half of the decline we've seen would have been accounted for just because of aging, if the behaviors were the same. We know they're not exactly the same. Young folks are working less within ages, and older folks are working a little bit more as they're closer to retirement. But as a back of the envelope, that serves us well. And so we are starting to get back, but we're about halfway back, I think, in terms of closing that gap where we think we should be based on demographics of where we are. But the improvement recently has been very stark, and in some of the national surveys, we've seen a lot of folks coming off the sideline in terms of being, you survey them 1 month and they say, I don't have a job, I'm not looking for a job, I don't want one, and then you survey them the next month, and what do you know, they have a job. You know, someone, their old boss called and asked them back and sweetened it, or their neighbor said, hey, we've got, a position over here, you know, in our firm or whatnot. And so, yes, we are seeing a lot of improvement, maybe not as strong as it is in the data, but not quite. We certainly haven't repaired all the damage done by the recession yet.
You can let him go. I have several follow-up, but he can jump in.
Representative Nuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This presentation is one of the better parts of serving on the Revenue Committee. It's fascinating. In times past, I think you guys have sometimes shared stuff with us about what's going on in the housing market or what's happening in housing. I noticed there were any slides about that, and so if you can't go off the cuff, that's fine. But what are we seeing in that space in terms of our available housing stock or the housing, the housing market?
Senator Hass, Representative Nose, if this is one of the most exciting things you do for the Revenue Committee, I feel for you all. I appreciate your service. But the housing market. I'm sorry, and I know we have new faces now, so we probably should have brought more out. It's certainly topical. It's what we get asked most anything, but we've been giving you some overkill with it. But the story is pretty clear that there's something that's broken on the supply side, that we're not getting the same kind of supply of housing, and it's across all areas. It's not just a Portland metro phenomenon. It's across the state where we're seeing very low affordability measures, even in some of our rural and areas with very little population growth about building. So in rural Oregon, they have about the same income level as the typical rural area in the U.S., but housing cost is in the 95th percentile. So it's extreme. And it's also across the U.S. If you look at other hip growing areas, that are drawing migrants and young migrants, places like Portland, if you look at Boise and Austin, and some of these places love to build, and they're building, and they don't have the same sort of restrictions we do, but nevertheless, in terms of zoning law and the like, but nevertheless, they're not keeping up with their population growth either. And these are the places that are building faster than anywhere. And so there's something going on that's holding down supply, and as a result, affordability has eroded.
Senator Boquist.
Follow up with the workforce participation. you also made mention that you were seeing a downturn in the utilization of government benefits, which I'm assuming are, frankly, under DHS and not OHA, because, as you see, OHA is up there. Can you quantify that in any terms at all?
Chair Hass, Senator Boquist, I don't want to misspeak. I just looked at some of the data yesterday, you know, because we have caseloads for all kinds of programs, and a lot of them are, you know, some aren't coming down, and some are, and there are technical issues in terms of our recertifications and the like that are going on in terms of the time of processing folks. But in general, we have seen caseloads. If we look regionally, the places that first turned out are starting to get lower caseloads in terms of just like the poverty rates. First to start turning down was the Portland metropolitan area. Then here over the last year, we started to see our mid-metros turn down, and so we're starting to see the caseloads go down there as well. But it's still in some of the rural areas that have been last to turn around. We have not quite seen improvement yet, but we do expect next year to start seeing some more positive numbers there if the timing is the same as it was for our larger population centers where the growth comes, and then a couple years later we start to see these benefits.
Final comment. Senator Boquist. I just want to remind everybody, and following up what Representative Smith pointed out there, and I'm sure my Republican colleague over to my right will agree, is that one of the problems with economics is you're working on acceptable data. And so we'll just use Yamhill County as an example. I mean, I have McMinnville is probably experiencing what you're suggesting. Sheridan and Willamina in the same county are not. I would wager that my colleague in Josephine County or even pick some of the edges of Washington County or some of the edges of Representative Barnhart's district out there have not yet experienced this recovery yet. And so the problem when we say rural data looks like we're increasing in jobs, those jobs still remain to be fairly centralized, and we still have massive geographic portions of the state that are not recovering, or they're stagnant, as you point out.
Absolutely. Chair House, Senator Boquist. Yes, and I didn't mean to say that. When I say it's as good as it gets, growing at 2% a year and having every county having added jobs over the last year, that is not to say that they've recovered all the jobs they lost during the recession. You know, 2% is only a small part of that for the typical rural area where they lost double digits in terms of their jobs in 1 year. And so, yes, although things may be improving, the problems are real.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nonetheless, it is heartening and gratifying to know that the recovery is beyond just the metro counties.
I agree.
Even though there are still some pockets of difficulty. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much. I've got a question and then a comment. The question really feeds off of some of the things that others have asked about the economic growth and the unevenness and so forth. And I'm wondering if there are implications for us around issues of job classification and retraining and that kind of thing, or if what we're seeing is a recovery of old systems, so putting people back to work in what they used to do is a relatively easy thing. Should we be doing things that help people? That's probably the wrong question to ask you. Do people need to train in new fields in order to get that difficult and stubborn areas into recovery?
Yeah, Senator Hass, Representative Barnhart. At the occupational level, there are a lot of permanent changes and structural changes that a lot of have to do with the impact of technology, and in particular that what's happening to middle wage jobs across the U.S. and in Oregon, where they're getting hammered during recessions and just not coming back. I'm going to let Josh talk about some of those occupational details because he's done a lot of work on that to that end.
Chair Hass, Representative Barnhart, as Mark was saying, right, there's been some permanent shifts and some permanent structural changes that some of these jobs just aren't coming back, and they're not expected to in the future. That's, you know, in the short term, everything's turned the corner, and we're adding, obviously, construction industry is coming back, manufacturing at least half of the lost jobs from the recession, right, which is pretty good for manufacturing, but that means we're not getting all the way. We're not going to get back 100% of our lost manufacturing jobs. We got about half of them, right? So what do you do with that other half? And so the near-term trends are more positive on some of these in terms of that short-term growth, but the longer-term trends are more pessimistic in terms of needing some sort of retraining or some other avenue to get into a job that has better long-term prospects. But yeah, there's a lot of different nuances there, and then you know the cost associated with any sort of retraining and the like. It's a big task.
Thank you. And then a comment, if I may, sir, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm the one in this group who tends to talk about how you're always wrong, and how your job is really difficult. And if you ever get close, it's sort of lucky. But I want to congratulate you on the steadiness with which the most recent forecasts have actually demonstrated your predictive capacity. You've been predicting a significant growth in Oregon now for some time. Your predictions back at the end of session in 2015 have turned out to be essentially correct. I mean the numbers difference that you have on this report that you've given us today are not materially different than what you told us then, and that suggests that the growth rates and the change in the economy that you predicted then has turned out to be the case. I'm hoping that the growth rate you're continuing to predict turns out to be right as well. Anyway, congratulations on having gotten the predictions in 2015 essentially correct. Having criticized before, I think I owe you the compliment now.
Thank you. Lucky this time.
Thank you. Yes, it's better to be lucky than good. That's the saying, and it's true.
Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of draw your attention to our new income in the state, the marijuana industry. How accurate are your records on how many people are involved in that industry, and do you have any predictions of the volume that's coming? Have you worked on this at all?
Senator Hess, Senator Bartschneider, we are not doing it yet. It's still under the houses of Department of Revenue. That said, for some reason, Josh takes a real interest in this and has been digging into it quite a bit. So I'm going to let him go ahead and talk a little bit about the preliminary job estimates. And the Employment Department's put together an industry category and the like, too. So we are starting to get some numbers.
I have a particular interest in new and informative data sets, not in necessarily extracurricular activities. But that's right. And so the Employment Department's working on categorizing and creating a marijuana cluster, if you will, in terms of the jobs and what have you. It's still really new. We don't have a full year of really good data to know how many jobs there are, but there's certainly at least a few thousand jobs, mostly associated with the growing and the retail operations. But how many customers, what share of the population, and what have you, as far as I'm aware of publicly available sources, we're still relying on survey data from pre-legalization, right, where 20% of the population said they used marijuana within the last month or something like that. It's actually a pretty high number up there with above the smoking rate, the tobacco smoking rate, if I recall. But how that's changed since legalization, I'm not aware of any, again, publicly available sources for that. You see stuff crop up in media reports over time. But that's something certainly tracking. And from the economic perspective, we get a lot of questions about. We care about not so much the growing and the selling operations, but the value-added manufacturing and the edibles and lab testing equipment and things that we can then sell and export to other states when they legalize, right? And so we look at the craft beer industry as sort of a predecessor here. And that's something I do have a lot of interest in. And so we have 11 of the 25 brewery system manufacturers in the country. 11 of the 25 are here in Oregon. And so when a new brewery opens in Cleveland or a new brewery opens in Mexico, for that matter, they're buying Oregon-made brew systems and brew houses, and we're exporting that. And so that's the sort of stuff we're hoping to see with the marijuana industry, to get that better value-added manufacturing and increase our industrial capacity here for the marijuana. And from an economic perspective, that's what we're looking for.
Senator Brookles.
Just as a follow-up, or actually an observation for everyone, since the beginning of session, we'll say since January, I probably had 15 to 20 of your data trackable marijuana folks that are either registered growers or retailers have contacted my office, or we've had discussions, and their anecdotal observation is that at least half of the people are doing it illegally still, that there are people growing and retailing. At least half of the market is still not in the regulatory format that we have right now. And that's the people that are coming and saying, hey, why am I complying and why are you making me do this when I can go right on eBay or right online and show you somebody doing it and nobody's doing anything about it. So I think we have a long ways to go in the regulatory scheme that the voters approved.
Okay. Going once, twice. Thank you, Mark McMullen, Josh Leonard. Good job.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So until May forecast, we'll keep grinding away here on our revenue bills. We have a presentation on a recent school run that the Senate was going to do. It'll take about 10 minutes. So if you, House guys can stay. We're going to do it right now, and we'll be done before 10 o'clock. Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, this is the update the local school formula revenue once a year because it's driven by property tax data. Of course, we get the bills have come in November, so today has gone through that, and property taxes, of course, is the largest revenue source for the schools. It's not state. And we'll go through our latest estimates, and these will be the estimates that will be built into the co-chair's budget when they develop the state school fund, and then he'll make the runs on what that means for the 197 districts, and on a per-student basis, weighted student basis, and so forth. But these will be the revenue numbers that he'll use along with whatever the state puts in through the state school fund.
Thank you, Paul. Chair Haas, members of the committee, and invited guests of House Revenue Committee. For the record, this is Dave Back, Legislative Revenue Office. So after color for presentation by Mark and Josh, my presentation will be very dry and monotone and focusing on numbers. But what they just mentioned in delivering economic and revenue forecast is pretty much relevant, except one. Property taxes tend to lag behind the economy a little, so there's so-called hysteresis in terms of net assessed value increase and property tax collections. You can see the data that I'm going to present to you today. But couple of background slides. First, local revenues are added to state school fund to form the total formula revenue for distribution to school districts and education service districts. Operationally, there are so-called carve-outs set aside from the state school fund. So local revenues are added to the state school fund that are carve-outs from the top to form the formula revenue for distribution to school districts and ESDs, and then you know the division between the two. Local revenues for the purpose of state school fund distribution, mostly property taxes based on permanent rates, about 95% of it. Common school fund distribution, about $110 million for biennium. There are state-managed forest land-related revenues, that goes into county school fund and state timber revenue, sale revenue, that is. And then we used to have federal timber payment, but stopped in 15-16, so we don't anticipate that. Occasional federal funds with a specific application and not deemed non-supplantable and highly technical term, but the last time we saw this was during Great Recession, about $110 million distributed. Money is in lieu of property taxes. So get to the number, 17-19, local revenues, anticipated local revenues altogether is $3.961 billion. This is about $22 million less than estimated last year. And this was the number actually used in budget preparation. So in terms of budget consideration for this year, this is the number, $3.961 billion. This is the number that we transmitted to Legislative Fiscal Office and Chief Financial Office at DAS. Now, this is our best estimate, and this is the number that we present to State Revenue Forecast Technical Committee. We are in close contact with ODE and LFO and CFO offices in terms of discussing the numbers. So we are sort of on the same page. The latest 15-17 local revenue estimate stands at $3.678 billion. 2 years ago, we estimated about $3.673 billion. So there is not much difference between the estimate and current estimate. Offsetting errors, of course, play a big part. Forecast details. In terms of property taxes, the school district's property taxes are expected to grow 16-17 property tax year, we had 4.3% growth in school districts, 4.1 in ESDs. Year before, it was 4.9 and 4.4. And 2 years before, it was 4.9 and 4.6 around. Now, that assessed value grew 4.04% last year. And the year before, it was 4.6. Now, what the economic and revenue forecast in the background, we anticipate that the property tax would grow steadily, but just like economic forecast, we're going to have a little bit of slowdown. So we forecast that the school property taxes would go up by about high sevens, high threes, and up to 4% a year. And although it's not really volatile, well, it is volatile. If you look at this statewide property tax trends, you see net assessed value, the blue line. Local governments don't have diverse revenue sources. And this property tax makes a huge difference. So from 5% to 1% to 2%, that's a huge decline. So over time, school property taxes and ESD property taxes tend to converge to this net assessed value growth. But in down times, the property taxes tend to, say, overshoot on the downside, when the net assessed values are declining, and you see that. And then when net assessed values are increasing, again, you see overshooting on the upside. And you look at 2009 through 2017 chart, the economy already was at a recession in 2009, but then we continued to have decline in net assessed values. And of course, the economy didn't quite recover starting from there, but the economy showed signs of recovery in 2011, 12, 13. Now we had some good housing starts at that time, but at a very low level. That didn't help much. And even then, that impact came in late. So we saw net assessed value improving starting from 2013 and on. So recently you see net assessed values and property taxes being plateaued at this point. And that trend is expected to continue a little bit lower, right? Now, if you talk to your commissioners and assessors, they would say they expect about the same rate of property tax growth this year. But you look at the counties, Morrow and Mohair posted over 10% growth. You look at the very left ones based on permanent levy, permanent rates. So the big counties showed about 4 to 4.5% growth. So there's a big variation in terms of property tax growth. So it depends on who you talk to. Common School Fund showed marginal growth.
Second, Dave, quick question.
Yeah, on that last chart, I noticed Klamath has got an exceptionally large growth. Am I seeing that right, Klamath County?
Yeah. Klamath showed 1.7.
Well, then I'm
seeing on the, you're saying on the bonds.
Oh, there. Okay, that's the bonds. I can't see that.
Oh, by the way, it's local option and bonds don't come into a formula revenue, actually.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Only the permanent rate based. Yes.
And Day, I apologize, but we're getting close to the end here.
Right. So then you have the charts, and then this is the numbers. Of course, the details. But the bottom line is, go back. The anticipated revenue for 17-19 is $3.961 billion, which is about $228 million above 15-17 level. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, all right. Questions of Day. Thank you very much. And so the school run, the annual, when will that?
Mr. Chair, we've got the set the local estimate. And so when we look at different numbers from the co-chairs in terms of what the state school fund will be, then they will start doing runs for them. So with these numbers, he can look at any level. And for example, look at what the co-chairs have put into their framework budget, for example.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Interesting day today here in the Senate Revenue Committee. We are formally not meeting until Monday, making way for some work group discussions, and so we'll see you all then. We are adjourned. We'll see you all then. We are adjourned. And,